This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
I'm going to go first with my guest, Kerry Jewell. She is a writer and a physician and is here to chat about her first novel, A Little Unwell. Welcome, Kerry.
Thanks so much for having me, Lisa.
You're so welcome. Now, A Little Unwell is a candid and insightful story that follows a junior doctor, Amy, as she navigates the intense pressures of hospital life. The book offers an honest and often darkly humorous look at the emotional toll of caring for others while quietly struggling with their own mental health, or with her own mental health. The book highlights the gap between public perception of the healthcare system and the reality. I just wondered, was that the key motivation behind writing this book for you? That I'll just repeat that part of that sentence if you wanted to hear that again. What it does for me was it highlights the gap between public perception of the healthcare system and the reality.
Yeah, look, that was definitely one of the aims. There were a lot of things that went into this book. I wrote it over 10 years, so the themes kept layering in the longer I spent in the public health system. But I think this is one of the things that I hopefully have achieved with this book, helping to shine a light on what's really going on. Useful for anyone that is consuming healthcare as a patient or a loved one visiting, your loved ones in hospital, but also for the people that are coming through as medical students, junior doctors and other healthcare workers.
So, that definitely came across. There are so many different aspects to this novel that you can find as an entry point here. So many different characters. And it also sort of served this, I guess, this prurient nature that I have about wanting to know what goes on, you know, like a fly on a wall in the ward sort of thing. And I really enjoyed that aspect because I felt like I could, oh, this is so interesting. I can see what kind of might be happening on the ward. So what do you think most people misunderstand about working in healthcare today?
Oh, wow, what a nebulous question. Let me focus in. At the start of this book, I have a little glossary of terms, the hierarchy of the roles that doctors play in the hospital. I think that's something that is often misunderstood if you are not in healthcare and you're coming in to consume, wondering who all these people are. So when you become a doctor, you've finished medical school, you've been a medical student, but there are all these roles that you play as you come through. You start as an intern, which is your first year out of university, and then as you're starting to learn a little bit more in the hospital environment, you become a resident. When you're in a training program, you're a registrar, and you continue through until you are a consultant. And that can be very confusing if you are hearing that, oh, you're seeing a resident or a registrar, not knowing, you know, are they a doctor? Are they still training? Should they be touching me? From the very start of this book, I'm trying to give the general public more information to empower them so that when they are in a healthcare setting, they hopefully can feel a little bit more confident about, yeah, who is touching them. That's not necessarily where I wanted this to go, but that's where we're at.
But there's very much a human element in this story. And there's no sort of sense of being educated in there. You really are driven with along with the characters. You're taken along with the characters. So, of course, you learn stuff, but it doesn't feel like that. And there are moments in this book where are quite visceral as well. And, like, there's a recurring shoulder relocation that feels strikingly real. And how important was it for you to capture those visceral hands-on experiences that you might have in the hospital?
Oh, so important. I was really aware while writing it that maybe a large part of the audience would be people that work in healthcare, and it can really pull you out of medical fiction when you come across things that aren't real. So a good example would be in televised medical fiction when you're watching someone do CPR, and working in healthcare, you're watching that going, the depth of those compressions are not going to be saving anyone. I'm totally pulled out. So it was critically important for me to make it feel as real as possible. And look at contemporary TV, I think this is why The Pitt is doing so well, because it just feels so real and honest. And because they do the medicine so accurately and so well, you can invest more in the human stories that are being told by that show. And so I have been describing this book to people as The Pitt if it was set in a Melbourne hospital, but also the doctors are funnier and hotter and maybe a bit more deranged.
Yeah, this book is really funny, and that struck me from the very beginning, which is that your voice, your authorial voice, is very strong, and it, even without the medical content, it's like it really does draw you in. So the protagonist, Amy, another thing that really, enraged me, but also, I thought this was a very important aspect to this book. Amy, the protagonist, encounters so very clear and persistent sexism in her role as a doctor. So how did you approach portraying that aspect of her experience, I guess?
Yeah, this was a little bit tough. And I think it's worth mentioning that sort of the origin for this book came in being recommended another book when I was a medical student and then junior doctor called The House of God by Samuel Shem, which came out in 1978. And it is an enduring text that is still recommended to medical students and junior doctors today. And it was maybe one of the first books to really be quite truthful about what the junior doctor experience is like. It was, I think, a little bit scandalous at the time when it came out in America in the 1970s. But it's still recommended, and it's what a lot of shows like Scrubs or other medical shows are based on in some way. You find some of the rules and the terms that are outlined in House of God come up in those shows and other medical fiction. It's just part of our lore now. But when I was recommended this book, when I was in my late teens or early 20s, I put it off for a while because people had warned me about it, and I finally read it when I was an intern, and I was, on the one hand, I was surprised in some ways to read what I was reading, but I was also deeply disappointed because it didn't speak to who I was as a junior doctor at that stage. So, for example, none of the interns in this book are female. It's deeply misogynistic, sexist, racist, and really is a product of its time. So, again, I think it's an important historic text for context, but it saddened me that this is what we were still recommending. Mm. And there are plenty of other good medical fiction books that have come out since, even here in Australia. So like Emotional Female by Neela Janakiramanan has come out a few years ago. Emotional Female by Yumiko Kadota, which is a memoir, and then The Registrar by Neela Janakiramanan are two recent examples of really good books. But they're sort of set more in the surgical field, and I've been more internal medicine. So I've been writing since 2015, and I wanted to represent something that was closer to my experience, hoping that, if I wrote the book that I wish I could have read back as a medical student, that could help other people as well. And also, I have a different take on things, so maybe there are things that I can write about that haven't really been discussed before. But then coming back to that point about misogyny, I feel like in some ways the character of Chris in this novel is kind of like the main character from House of God, Roy, if he existed in the 21st century.
Right.
And so I think that's a nice little contrast, thinking about, okay, well, what would a character like Amy, what would she have been doing in the House of God universe, and just contrasting that. So coming back to your original question about misogyny, I didn't want to hit people over the head with it, and I didn't want to go down the avenue of, the trope of young female doctors sleeping with their bosses, which often features in medical fiction, and not to discount how important that discussion is, but I didn't want that to be the only reductive conversation about junior female doctors and how they come up. So I thought there were other conversations to be had about how female doctors are still treated in the workplace. And a lot of that is subtly sprinkled through the book, and maybe it's only that you get to the end when you feel the collective weight of everything that Amy has experienced over the course of this year in her working life.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely comes across, sort of speckled across, as you say. But there are significant moments where, for example, she gets on a plane, and she gets on the plane with her partner, Chris, and they address him as doctor and they address her as miss. And she's got the same title on her boarding pass as well. And those sort of small but really kind of important details are all collected there in the book as well. I also think there's that you discuss sort of the stress on doctors quite, you show that very, very well. And I think many readers might be surprised by how difficult life is for doctors. I mean, I certainly had no idea about this time pressure and all of the stress that's surrounding and all of the, you know, you must work after your grandmother's funeral sort of situation, which is basically neglectful in a certain way. So do you think this system is in some ways neglectful of its workers?
Oh, absolutely. I was really looking forward to coming through the hierarchy and finally being a consultant myself so I could reach back and help junior doctors. I've been on a lot of committees and working groups and things over the course of my career trying to make small changes, but it is so difficult, and I actually think it's getting harder for junior doctors, not easier. And I'm really sad about how the legitimate concerns of a lot of junior doctors are just so easily dismissed. And often it comes under the heading of, you should be grateful that you're here. It's kind of like Devil Wears Prada, like a million girls would kill for this job. And like, yes, it is very competitive and difficult to get into medical school. It's true. But that doesn't mean that we should dehumanize medical students and junior doctors. And, you know, all of the junior doctors are still living the same sort of life as everyone else. Still have to get to the post office, still have to go do their groceries, still have to do all of these things while dealing with these, you know, big emotional, psychologically taxing jobs that they do in the hospital. So, yeah, I really hope that this causes some reflection and that we can continue to improve the experience, because for me, it's a straight line through to safe patient care, and that's ultimately what this is all about. The better we look after our healthcare staff, the better care that can be given to patients.
Yeah, I completely agree, and that definitely comes across in the book. So I'd like to thank you, Kerry, for being my guest. I think this book will do. It's such a fascinating and entertaining read. So thank you, Kerry Jewell. And the book is called A Little Unwell. It's published by Hachette. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Lisa.
Oh, thank you, Lisa. Now, the games of childhood take on a darker undertone in Julian Negri's The Belly of the Wolf. So, Julian, welcome to 3CR.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
Now, the wolf has many guises, and I can actually remember playing that schoolyard game, What's the Time, Daddy Wolfie? It's dinner time. Who is the wolf in this instance, and what is her relationship to the narrator, who's called Red?
Well, I used the idea of Little Red Riding Hood to structure this book, because I wanted to show how important our childhood is, especially when we're teenagers. It's all we've got behind us is our childhood. So I wanted to use something from childhood to be a linchpin for this character's life, to show exactly where she's at. Because it's hard for adults to remember being 15, but when you're 15, the majority of your life is childhood, but you don't want to play childhood games anymore. So what do? How do you survive? And so I wanted to use something universal. So I used Little Red Riding Hood. And then from that, I sort of extrapolated all the wolfish type archetypes we have through our games, like and through our literature. That actually influences the character's identity. So in the book, the children were cast in a play, and the best friend was cast as the wolf, and the main character in this book, Red, was cast as Little Red Riding Hood. And so I used that as a way that they developed their identity and also their relationship.
But it also speaks to the sort of haunting background behind the fairy tales and nursery rhymes of potential danger.
Yes, I wanted to have that hint of danger there, that is for all kids and for all people, that life is dangerous, and that's what fairy tales tell us.
Yeah, and then you have Wolf and Red, and that's how we know them in the story. They've met at primary school. Grabbing both my hands in hers, she said, I'm going to be your best friend. I mean, the story is set years after that childhood encounter, and Red actually suffers a trauma, but that the trauma is directly proportional to that sort of excitement and intensity of that meeting in childhood.
Yeah, almost like I use the metaphor of a seesaw.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's that moment, and you think, oh, well, that's wonderful. They've got a friendship that, hey, with expectations, going to endure for life. but then challenges emerge. Now, she has to go back to school after a severe trauma. This is Red having to go back to school, and that could be challenging for anyone, especially an adolescent. And here we go. Everybody is nice, but that doesn't mean I have to like them. Val would understand, but Mrs. Chapman takes me aside. It's about your demeanour, she says. I'm concerned. Your mood is dark. You don't interact. Your words are all staccato syllables that stick in my brain. Act, mean, mood, dark. Yes, I say, I act mean and dark. I don't want friends. But you're a lovely girl. If you just, what? I say, lighten up. I know with Mrs. Chapman it's all about adding more white, creating the pastel. If you made an effort, she says, a smile costs nothing. Mrs. Chapman is a walking cross-stitch book of proverbs. I'll try, I say, because even as dark and mean as I act, there's no need to turn her pastel view murky. Now, there's some interesting things going on here. First of all, Red coming back to school and the challenge. It's inordinately difficult.
Yeah, she talks about always. She's always going to be out of time with the others. You know, she's come back and the group that she sits with are no longer there. She doesn't know where to sit at school. She's doesn't have a pen. She's unprepared.
And also then, the two other people that are mentioned here, Val, who was a teacher she identified with, and Mrs. Chapman, whom she doesn't. Mm. And that difficulty of finding somebody you can relate to.
Yeah, and I think the other thing about teenagers is, you know, they can be very judgmental. You know, we judge our friends. We say, oh, she's the hot girl, he's the jock. You know, we put everybody into boxes. And I think Red is quite judgmental of her teacher, Mrs. Chapman.
But there's an interesting sort of outcome to that. And what does she discover about Mrs. Chapman and Val later in the book, once she's acquired a bit of knowledge?
Yeah, she sort of learns to appreciate that there is wisdom in Mrs. Chapman that belies her appearance, and that Mrs. Chapman has actually been someone who has helped someone through a trauma.
Yeah.
And has helped Val.
And has had first-hand experience. But again, as an adolescent, you don't have that breadth of knowledge to see those things.
No, and I really wanted to capture that in the book, that when you're 15, like I said, all you have behind you is childhood and you don't have any perspective, which is why everything that happens is so meaningful.
And Red says, I'm trying on a different persona and so far it's working. I'm functioning. Turns out I couldn't see the wood for the trees. Red is haunted by a memory. Now, what is that memory? We're going to touch on a delicate subject here.
Yeah, so for Red, she keeps trying to move forward and live her life, but she's always snapped back by this memory, by this trauma, because Red left her, because Wolf left in very traumatic circumstances. And so because Wolf died, Red feels like she's just always going to be pulled back into her childhood, pulled back to this moment when Wolf left.
But also then we've get the inverse of that intensity of the friendship they first formed, and now we've got the exact opposite of what has taken place. The intensity is in fact a danger.
Yes, for Red the friendship was intense, but it also gave her identity. It became who she was. She's Red because Wolf is Wolf. And if Wolf is gone, then who is Red? So the loss of Wolf doesn't just cause grief. It causes this complexity.
Well, Red feels guilty.
Well, yes, because part of the responsibilities that come with being a best friend, especially when you're a teenager and you're a child, you know, phrases like best friend hold a lot of sway. You know, if you're someone's best friend, you're a very important person. Friendships are the most important thing when you're young. And because Wolf has committed suicide and Red didn't know that was going to happen, and Wolf has chosen to leave Red behind without telling her this very important thing, Red thinks, well, the obvious extrapolation from that is that she was a terrible best friend, that Red wasn't very good at being a best friend.
Well, Red feels guilty, Red feels responsible, and should have, you know, accountable, all of these. But there wasn't anything she could have done in many ways.
But she doesn't have enough experience of life to know that.
She seems to be taking on the burden of Wolf's actions in trying to account for them. But here we go. Interestingly, Red is actually a very gifted individual. And there are all of these others that are attempting to help her. She forms an association with Music Girl. And there's an inordinate amount of generosity in this friendship. What's going on there?
Yeah, Music Girl was a great character to write because she's uncomplicated in her generosity. She's warm. She loves music. She just wants to create. She's got a lovely support in her family. And it sort of contrasted to where Red was at. But also Red doesn't feel like she deserves any help.
Yeah, and this is the problem. I mean, Music Girl's mother actually gives Red free piano lessons because they've recognised this talent in Red. And yet Red can't accept it as much. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think this isn't uncommon for people who are grieving someone who has died from suicide. The complexity of the grief is often very self-destructive, and I've seen that happen a lot. And that's partly what inspired me to write the book, was that I did see a young person going through that and had lost a best friend and was spiralling into self-destructive behaviour. And I recognised that, and I thought, oh, this isn't something that just happened to me as a teenager. This is something that happens. And, you know, by the time someone is 25, one in two young people have been affected by suicide in some way.
I wasn't aware of that statistic. But also then, that notion of generosity in direct proportion to the weight of the darkness that people experience as well. It's in equal proportion in the world in some ways.
Yeah, it's like it is like a seesaw or like an inverse. The grief is the inverse of the love.
We've also got Popular Boy. Mm. Interestingly, you're naming all the other characters just sort of with labels in some ways. But here's an interesting thing. Adolescents coming to an awareness of their sexuality and all of these sorts of things. But this becomes a very complex sort of relationship. Popular Boy, yes, nice to be going out with a popular boy. But what does Red discover? What does she actually do when it comes to this boy?
Yeah, I think one of the things about naming everybody just Popular Boy, Older Sister, and just giving them those sort of names was partly just because of fairy tale archetypes. It sort of fit in with the fairy tale archetype, but also, like I was saying, with that judgmental way that teenagers are, that sort of a code, you know, you're the weird girl, you're the popular boy, you know, you're the arty type, you know, we have all these sort of code words. So with Popular Boy, you know, Red finds that she gets hurt, but that feeling of being hurt actually makes her remember the hurt from Wolf and makes her feel closer to Wolf in some ways.
Well, Popular Boy betrays her.
Mm, as popular boys often do.
As popular boys often do. And that's something adolescents have to experience and get become familiar with.
Yeah.
But it's also then heightened by the fact that she's still carrying the guilt for Wolf's departure.
Well, I think she says somewhere that you get the love that you deserve.
Well, here we go. Does she? Because basically she goes back to Popular Boy. Popular Boy has betrayed her, and yet she goes back. And there's a complex sort of dynamic here.
Mm.
Why does she go back?
Yeah, it's interesting because I wanted to set up a love triangle in a way, and so the love triangle is Music Girl and Popular Boy and Red, and I wanted that to kind of drive the narrative. But, you know, you've got this lovely, generous friendship, but there's risks with friendship. Red knows that. You get really hurt with friendships. Yes, you get hurt with Popular Boy, but you get, once you've been hurt and you go back to it, you know what you're getting into.
It's more than that. I think she doesn't feel as if she should be respected.
No, you get the love that you deserve. Yeah.
With him, I'll never feel shocked. I know what I'm getting. But with Music Girl, everything hurts more because my heart breaks for who I could have been in another world where I could still be someone's best friend. And so we go back to this intensity of that childhood friendship and now I don't deserve that intensity. I will go and be the friend of somebody who is going to betray me simply because I will never experience that hurt again to the same degree.
Yeah, it's almost a self-protective way of going into destruction. And I think, you know, one of the guides I used when I was writing this book was not to live your life is the same as suicide, it just takes longer, which is a quote from Gloria O'Brien's History of the Future by A.S. King. And I think that self-destruction is kind of like, I don't deserve to keep living, but I'm not going to commit suicide. So how do I balance that?
And Popular Boy also undermines her musical talent as well, and she allows this to happen because she feels she doesn't deserve more. I'm going to pivot here a little. You've told this in verse. The reasons for doing that?
Part of it was just intuitive. So I started just writing poems about that time when I was 15 and did lose my best friend to suicide. And so the grief poems in there were sort of bubbling up inside me. And then I thought about how could I connect it in a narrative and thought about the love triangle and those sorts of things. And verse just seemed like a natural way to do it. I also, for me, it's quite a traumatic space, so writing in a fragmentary way of just having to concentrate on a verse rather than feel like I was concentrating on a whole book was almost a way of tricking myself into being able to do it.
Well, it's given you the ability to come up with some killer lines. You were extraordinary in all the wrong places. And so a single line can just hang there, redolent with meaning, but also then there's an ambiguity, I guess, or the potential to interpret more deeply when things are in verse. Here's one. Venus infers, I wear wolf like a coat. Heavy, sure, heavy, but a unique warmth and protection from future shock and ambush. Grief, it is our love, relentless and restless, to find somewhere to dwell. There's no definitive meaning to it. It opens it up for interpretation.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is that almost every verse in the book has a song title as its title. So I used a lot of pop music to listen to when I was writing it. So I feel like they're almost like little love songs. Yep.
Well, unfortunately, Julianne, we're going to have to finish our interview there. But I think it's very important to raise the fact that both the texts today have raised concerns about mental health. Who would you recommend contacting for such things as help when it comes to suicide and those concerns?
Lifeline is fantastic. It's 13 11 14. And for younger people, the Kids Helpline is the place to go. 1-800-55-1800.
And you'd concur with that?
I would. And we also have Beyond Blue, 1300 22 46 36.
And I'd just like to say that suicide is the number one killer of young people in this country.
Mm. Something to...
to think about.
Yeah, to think about. We're going to have to get out of here, Lisa.
And, well, thank you, our guests, for being such wonderful guests.